my mother grew up with, she was the oldest of six kids, and her mother was a flight attendant during a period where it was a really exciting thing to be a flight attendant. And when she was pregnant, she had to avoid telling her boss that she would be becoming a mother because it would be the end of her career. And ultimately it was the end of her career. And so, you know, I think that this is just one of many, many, many things, one of many, many ingredients, which is to say that the oppression of women, the religious indoctrination and the depression and despair and hopelessness of the era and the arrogance and naivete of the politicians who were making decisions that would pave the way for the rise of fascism, you know, 15 years later, that all of those things were contributing factors. So the movie sort of touches on all of them.
The voice of Brady Corbett there, the actor turned director, discussing his new film, The Childhood of a Leader. More from him shortly. You're tuned to The Cinema Show here on Monocle 24, also ahead.
So even before I finished the final draft, I contacted him and I told him, listen, I have this crazy idea and I want to know if you want to consider it.
Pablo Trapero takes us to the dark underworld of Argentina with his Silver Lion winning film, The Clan. And a little later,
the emotions that it's dealing with are so kind of big. It just really appeals to me on that kind of very hitting you in the heart level.
Little White Lies editor David Jenkins reveals his deep affection for the 1946 Western classic My Darling Clementine in this week's Critics' Choice. That's all to come on The Cinema Show here on Monocle 24. Hello from Midori House in London, I'm Ben Rylan. What's the first movie you remember seeing? For me, it's Superman, the 1978 classic, starring Christopher Reeve. Not at a cinema, sadly, but via a primetime screening on Australian television in the late 1980s. When people ask me for my all-time favourite scene from any movie, just one comes to mind. That incredibly cinematic moment where Superman takes flight to the top of the Daily Planet newspaper headquarters, catching a free-falling Lois Lane in one hand and a helicopter in the other. I still find that scene completely thrilling. The films we see when we're young often have a profound impact on how we devour the art form later. When the Australian film critic Glenn Dunks first visited a cinema, it was also to bear witness to a comic book adaptation with more than a few artistic differences to the kind we're used to seeing today. Here's Glenn's essay recalling that experience way back in 1990, as performed by the actor Daniel Clemens.
I don't remember much about my first experience at the cinema. Certainly not the particulars. Did I eat popcorn? Or was I allowed sweet lollies? Did I cry? Or was it a case of instant love, the giant, empty white screen in front of me, as my mother, my brother, and I entered the auditorium? I do, however, remember the movie and the sensory experience of it all. The vivid memory of sitting in the darkened cinema, colours hitting me like punches. Boy, do I remember the colours. The movie was Dick Tracy. What a movie to start one's cinematic diet on. Warren Beatty's adaptation of Chester Gould's famed comic strip is famously steeped in bold primary colours, a nod to the character's original home in newspaper comic pages that rarely ventured from yellow, red and blue drawings in telling its tale of Chicago's best detective battling the criminal underground. If cartoons are the most popular form of childhood entertainment, and Dick Tracy was a cartoon come to life. The look of Dick Tracy was old-fashioned, utilizing traditional and elaborate matte paintings, plus classic prosthetic makeup in tandem with visual effects. This created a space that today I can recognize as a tribute to classical filmmaking techniques. This was the first style I ever saw, no doubt shaping my affection for practical effects and handmade movies. Beatty even hired acclaimed actors like Al Pacino and Dustin Hoffman to play outlandish characters, as if hoping to imprint young audiences with an early dose of the new Hollywood movement, while at the same time building an appreciation of the 1930s jazz age.
Boys, we're back in business! Maybe I'll run for mayor myself.
What was it that inspired my mother to take me to see Dick Tracy? I was only 5 at the time. My memory is a little foggy. It was 26 years ago, which is why my mother's memory is so foggy too. No doubt my brother, 5 years older, had more of a say than I. Despite the Tommy guns and the freakish cartoon-like makeup designs of the villains, Beatty's film was marketed as a film for kids. McDonald's, collectibles and all. It was old-fashioned. A Hollywood blockbuster for those too young for Arnold Schwarzenegger. We would later go and see Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and a year later it was Steven Spielberg's Hook, although I forced my family to leave that one early because I didn't think it was any good. A telltale sign of my future as a critic. Maybe my mother suspected it would pique my interest due to the burgeoning interest in Madonna, who had a starring role as Breathless Mahoney, a Veronica Lake-inspired femme fatale and love interest in Beatty's Dick Tracy. The singer and sometime actress had been on the charts with Vogue for some 6 months, and I was in love. The song, from the film's tie-in soundtrack, and its memorable black and white music video, directed by a soon-to-be very famous David Fincher, were impossible to ignore at the time. Radio was obsessed. Television was obsessed. The movies were obsessed. And now I was obsessed. I kept VHS tapes of her music videos that I recorded on TV, even at age 5. I would later discover her earlier breakthrough performance as a punk drifter on the streets of Manhattan's Lower East Side in Susan Seidelman's Desperately Seeking Susan. I would revel in the pluck she displayed as a wartime baseball star in A League of Their Own, and even found much to admire in her portrayal of Eva Peron in the film version of Andrew Lloyd Webber's Evita. Like I said, I don't remember many of the specifics of my first trip to the movies, but I do remember Madonna and that platinum hair. I remember Warren Beatty's bright yellow trench coat flapping against a rain-soaked pavement as shadowed silhouettes danced on the walls. Most importantly, I remember loving it. Of course, for many, childhood favourites are typically less appreciated as we get older, or at least we're told that we're meant to think that way. We ought to see these films as juvenile, or not really cinematic art on the same level as Scorsese or Coppola. But that thinking does a film like Beatty's immense injustice. Beyond my own appreciation, I believe Dick Tracy was an early precedent for this cultural shift towards better quality children's entertainment, personified by the likes of Pixar. Dick Tracy is artistic and doesn't treat its audience, young or old, as idiots. It doesn't believe in the cynical idea that audiences need modern effects and acting techniques to connect. I thank Dick Tracy for my not becoming the sort of person who laughs at an Alfred Hitchcock film simply because it doesn't conform to modern filmmaking. You know the types. It was almost as if it were meant to be. Of course, Dick Tracy was the first film I saw in the cinema. It just makes sense. Would I have turned out the same if we had waited a month and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles was the first? Or heaven forbid, Hook. As Madonna sings on the soundtrack, I wanted more, more, more. And Dick Tracy is to thank.
An essay by the Australian film critic Glenn Dunks there, performed by the actor Daniel Clemens. Now for a look at a childhood of an entirely different kind. The childhood of a leader takes us inside the home of Prescott, the irritable and rather unpredictable 10-year-old son of an American diplomat based in France a year after the end of the First World War. It's tempting to make comparisons with the frightening doom of The Omen or other such classic scary children, but the film is far more sedate than any standard horror. First-time director Brady Corbett spent his own childhood in front of the camera in acclaimed films such as 2003's 13 and Mysterious Skin the following year. His directorial debut is ambitious, unsettling, and surely a sign of great things to come. I spoke to Brady about how his first feature was born and what fascist dictators of the past might tell us about modern politics.
He's been acting out of it.
Hey! That's only a little boy. He didn't actually hurt anyone, did he?
I'm sorry, Mama.
Why would you want to hurt anyone?
Do you like it here?
Why don't you lead us in a prayer, my love?
No.
Basically, the order of things was that I discovered a book by Margaret Macmillan, who is a relative of Churchill's, who's a great lecturer and a fantastic historian, who had written a book on the 6 months leading up to the signing of the Treaty of Versailles. And I was really haunted by it, and it seemed especially relevant when I discovered the book because it was during the period that America was, you know, engaged in the war in Iraq. And the book seemed particularly relevant to me, I suppose, because it was the moment that American foreign policy, as we know it, was established. And, you know, Woodrow Wilson was sort of the grandfather of the UN with his League of Nations. And basically what happened then was that I knew that I wanted to tell a story about this event. And I was trying to figure out a sort of poetic way of dealing with it so that it wouldn't turn into a kind of PBS special. And so I sort of started thinking of a story about a child who's sort of possessed by the notions of the era. And then basically I discovered an article or an essay online that was called The Childhood of a Leader. And I didn't know at that point that it was actually took its title from Jean-Paul Sartre. I had read No Exit, and I had read, you know, Being in Nothingness and like a lot of his famous essays, but I actually wasn't familiar with the story. And so after a while of thinking that I was going to reappropriate this title from an article, I realized that I was actually reappropriating the title from a short story that already existed. Then I read the short story, and that was 8 years ago or something. And what was interesting is that I had already been developing the sort of characterization of a young boy that was incredibly effeminate because of a photo I'd seen of Mussolini as a child who really looked like a little girl when he was sitting on his mother's lap. And then this was one of the details that sort of stood out about Jean-Paul's story. And so then I thought, okay, now I really have to call it The Childhood of a Leader and tip my hat at his story. I realized after reading it that his story was quite literal. I mean, it's about the early, not just childhood, but also the teenage experiences of a would-be fascist, sort of an anti-Semite. And so I was interested in doing something that was a little bit more universal than that.
It's sort of a political movie that doesn't concern itself with politics at all. It's more concerned about this nature versus nurture development of what makes a man and what are the ingredients that combine to create what he eventually stands for.
Yeah, the idea was basically to create a narrative which, you know, more or less completely avoids simplistic notions of causality and sort of suggests various causes but leaves the viewer to identify the prompting factors. I mean, the thing is that the idea was that you would have seemingly inconsequential events in this young man's life that might be just as important, if not more important, than certain sort of violent instances in his life or the way that is in which he's being treated by the adults around him.
The visuals are so beautifully put together. Interestingly, by the same cinematographer who did Andrew Haig's 45 Years, and this doesn't really share anything in common with that whatsoever. It feels like we're peering into a nightmarish vision of what this particular period in time might have been like. Is that a bit of an allegory for what the theme that you're trying to express and the kind of person that's being born here?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely it is. And you know, we were shooting in very low lighting conditions. So, of course, you're drawing out like a lot of grain, a lot of natural grain and stuff from the celluloid. And we were sort of, embracing styles that were both incredibly classical and occasionally very modern, and trying to find ways to sort of effortlessly blend the two until always it leading up to the final shot, which is a totally new, completely modern idea of what a camera should or can do. And it's funny because I always knew that the film would end with this image, faces in the crowd, hats, shoes, and a building, a neoclassical sort of building. And so everything was sort of built in service of that. And I knew it would be something quite dangerous to do. I mean, it was sort of a way of ruining a very elegant movie or a film that had been very elegant up to that point. However, I think that I always have a desire to fuck things up a little bit. It's just a little bit too banal and a little bit too easy to be only classical.
You found something so unsettling in the faces of children in this film. That may not be so surprising given the title of the film and the main character throughout, but even that final shot you mentioned, there's another child that we see and you stay upon that child's face. And that shot in itself is also very, very unsettling. I mean, we know about unsettling children in the theatre, of course. The Omen obviously springs to mind. But this film is expressing something a lot more serious, a lot more true to life.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that basically by sort of using a few elements of genre, we were able to get the film made. Like, it was a way of, you know, you could talk about The Shining or something in a pitch, and people go like, oh, I've seen that, I know what that's like. And so it was easier for them to relate to than maybe like an allegorical tale about the Versailles Treaty. And understandably, I mean, you know, that's completely normal, I guess. But, you know, the end, I really always wanted to end the film with an image of a young girl, a face in the crowd, a victim. And I thought that it was one of many ways that in the end of the film we're trying to talk about generations and the sort of poisonous seed that gets handed down from generation to generation. Because just like this young woman's face at the end of the movie, we have kids, you know, sitting in church at the end of the First War. The church is mostly filled up with women and who are all widowed. And so you see the way that these kids are processing something which is, you know, impossible to expect any child to really be able to process. I think that a lot of my work, or at least what I'm working on right now in my life, is about how unhealthy worship can be. The idea of assuming that a man can be bigger than you. It's absolutely absurd, you know. I mean, I grew up making movies since I was pretty young, acting in movies. And, you know, of course, because of that, I grew up with a lot of celebrities in my life. And having a little bit of an insider perspective, I realize how ridiculous it is to put anyone or anything up on a pedestal where it's impossible for them to fulfill their obligations. And everyone deals with that differently. Some people kind of retreat into the shadows, which is probably the healthiest thing you can do. And then other people actually start to drink the Kool-Aid and assume that they are as important as everyone's telling them they are.
Brady Corbett, director of The Childhood of Alida, which is out in theatres in some parts of the world now. You're listening to The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. We'll head to Argentina next.
Do you like good films? Well, you're in luck. The Cinema Show is presented in association with MUBI, the curated movie site of cult, classic and award-winning cinema. And we've got a special treat happening at the moment. Just for our loyal listeners, a whole month of movies for free. Head over to MUBI.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle. Because life is too short for bad films.
Report Card, brought to you by The Cinema Show. $900 million, that's how much Pixar's Finding Dory made at the box office since its release in June. It's the fourth Disney film to gross more than $900 million this year, following Captain America: Civil War, Zootopia, and The Jungle Book. The sequel to 2004's Finding Nemo also gave Disney its biggest ever opening for an animated film. $50 million, that's the estimated budget of Paramount's new original science fiction film, Arrival. Adapted from a short story by Ted Chiang, the film stars Amy Adams as an expert linguist recruited by the US government to communicate with mysterious spacecraft that may or may not be about to spark a global war. It's expected to hit theaters on November 11th. 18%, that's how much China's box office shrunk by this July, in what should have been its peak period. Just under $680 million was generated last month, compared to nearly $830 million at the same time last year. China is the world's second largest film market after the US. Analysts blame an uninspiring string of recent releases combined with an overall slowdown hitting the Chinese economy.
You're back with The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Ryland. When The Clan hit cinemas at home in Argentina, it broke domestic box office records. The film tells the story of the notoriously wealthy Puccio family and their involvement in four kidnappings and three murders throughout the 1980s. The much-loved actor Guillermo Francella is better known to local audiences for his comedic performances. Here, he takes a surprising turn as the menacing family patriarch. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to the award-winning director Pablo Trapero, who is visiting London for this weekend's fifth Argentine Film Festival.
The story is about El Clan Puccio, which was infamous back in the 80s because the father had kidnapped people. But the funny thing is that they have them at home. So, which was a crazy news, mostly because the social class of this family was unusual on the news. I mean, for this kind of crimes, you know.
You're fairly wealthy, right?
Yes. And the area in San Isidro, it's also a wealthy area. So it's not related with this kind of crimes, you know. It was a big news back then. I know, and the other big thing here is that the eldest son of Archimedes, Alejandro, which was a very famous rugby player and sort of star in the club, was the one in charge to point the victims, you know, which were his own friends.
Because of his connections, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that was really, really something that I couldn't ever forget.
Have you been in touch with the family before, during or while you were thinking to make the film?
Yeah, we tried, but they didn't want to talk to us. But we talked with a lot of people from San Isidro, Alejandro's friends, Alejandro's teammate, the trainers. We talked with the lawyers. We got access to pictures, family pictures.
Let's talk about acting as well. I mean, of course, the actor who played Archimedes, Guillermo Francella, he's an icon in Argentina, and he played wonderfully. And he's a very kind of cold and it's interesting because it's very unusual for this actor to play such a, you know, a villain, may I say. How did you get in touch with Guillermo for this?
It's an actor that I like for years, and I'm always was thinking, what can we do together? So even before I finished the final draft, I contact him and I told him, listen, I have this crazy idea and I want to know if you want to consider it, you know, because it would be really nice to be your answer even before I finish the draft, you know, to write the last things with you already confirmed. So he was very kind. He was really enthusiastic from the very beginning. He told me, yes, Pablo, I'm ready. And actually, it's also fun because he used to live around very close to this area, so he has a personal link with the story because it was not only something that he discovers on the news, but it was something that he lived by himself around, you know, around San Isidro.
Another thing that I really loved about the film, I mean, the soundtrack, I think it's very fun and represent the time as well. By any chance, did you choose the
yes,
soundtrack?
I did. I actually,
great choice.
Yeah, I'm happy about how it works because it's not only about the period, but it also portrays their cynicism, you know, because they used to put that music at home, the victims inside, you know, and with this both meaning like some sort of torture, but at the same time to hide the shouts of the people, you know, so it was like creates this sense of uncomfortable.
Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco there, chatting to the director, Pablo Trapero, about his film, The Clan, screening as part of this weekend's Argentine Film Festival here in London. It was also in competition at last year's Venice Film Festival, where Pablo took the Silver Lion Award. And finally today, the latest issue of Little White Lies magazine has just hit newsstands with a stunning collection of pages evoking the beautiful, dusty plains of the American Western. Director John Ford is, of course, the reigning king of the genre. There's even a popular section of Utah's Monument Valley named after him. His 1946 film, My Darling Clementine, is one of the most beloved films of Little White Lies editor David Jenkins. He walks us through the heartfelt classic for this week's Critics' Choice.
Oh, my darling Clementine, you are lost and gone forever. Careful, sorry, Clementine.
I'm looking for Dr. John Holliday.
You mean Doc Holliday?
Well, I imagine so.
Oh, Doc Holliday. Why, he rode out of town about 3 o'clock this morning, heading south. I don't know when he'll be back, man.
He'll most likely be back supper time. Maybe you'd like to have some breakfast freshen up a bit.
Oh, I would like some coffee.
Have you got a room for Miss...
Carter. Clementine Carter.
I guess you'd call them like genre films, like the Western genre, and you have certain expectations about who are the good guys, who are the bad guys, who are the romantic interests, the setting. And for me, this film just feels very kind of fresh and even a bit weird. It's a slightly sort of strange take on the sort of Western mythos. The character of Wyatt Earp, played by Henry Fonda, he's not your kind of, you know, John Wayne or Clint Eastwood or one of these kind of roistering Western heroes. He's very kind of laid back. He's slightly kind of confused by this sort of situation, and his kind of actions are sort of a bit more low slung and slow and thoughtful than maybe the kind of the classic Western would have. And it's so hard for me to explain. I think the films that I love, I almost think I can't explain why I love them, and that's why I love them.
And I'll give you the truth. The man you once knew is no more. There's not a vestige of him left, nothing. Come, I'll take you back to the hotel.
Please, John. You can't send me away like this. You can't run away from me any more than you can run away from yourself. Now I know why you don't care whether you live or die, why you've tried to get yourself killed. Well, I've heard all about you, John, and you're wrong. So wrong. You have no right to destroy yourself. You have a world of friends back home who love you, John, and I love you.
There's this amazing scene in the middle of the film where Wyatt Earp, like, it's a kind of romantic scene in the middle of the film where Wyatt Earp dances with Clementine, the Clementine character played by Kathy Downs, in front of this church. And it's like this really slightly awkward puppy love romantic scene, and it just absolutely slays me every time I see it. And it's, again, not the kind of scene you'd expect in a Western. It's very kind of coy, demure, romantic scene. And it's just very, very touching. And I guess for me, the film is quite an emotional film. And again, I wouldn't necessarily say that I'm being very kind of sweeping here in saying that Westerns don't tend to be emotional, but I'm sure there are loads that are. Like, all of Nick Ray's films are very emotional, but this one for me, it's like a kind of, it's almost like beyond melodrama. Like, it's kind of goes to melodrama, and then further along than that, I think the emotions that it's dealing with are so kind of big, and it just really appeals to me on that kind of very hitting you in the heart level, I guess.
David Jenkins there, editor of Little White Lies magazine. And that's it for this week's show. Tune in for my interview next week with the Spanish actress Rosy de Palma, star of many films by the director Pedro Almodóvar, including his latest work, Julieta.
But I knew inside me that something was waiting for me, that it was another kind of world, another universe.
That's Rosy de Palma coming up on next week's show. Today's program was edited by Claire Crofton and researched by Yolene Goffin. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast, and if you like, leave us a review. This has been The Cinema Show. I'm Ben Ryland. Thanks for listening.